Why do we not remember the histories of all these places? Because we have lost every geography. So you lose all memory of that, because memories are made by people. Where are those Hindus who have kept alive that memory in Pakistan? So loot, plunder has always been an intrinsic part of the manner in which Islam expanded since its founding by Muhammad, who is known as a prophet. Kabul comes from the Sanskrit word. It is named after Nadi, a river named Kuba. Kuba. From Kuba, you get the name of Kabul. So Ajaya Meru literally means, you know, Ajaya is that which cannot be defeated. Meru is a mountain. So literal meaning of Ajaya Meru is a mountain which cannot be defeated or conquered. So this corruption is Ajmer. What do you mean Brahmanabad? It is named Brahmanabad because of a mass genocide of, it was a Brahmin majority city. And it became known due to this genocide. None of them have left behind a dynasty. Aibak doesn't leave behind a dynasty. Iltutmish, he declares Razia as his successor. She gets murdered. So it's all, you know, palace coups and patricides and fratricides and all these things. No Sufi has ever harmed, like a proper Sufi saint had never carried a sword, you know, went out on a horse with a sword. No, generally the Sufis would allegedly spread the message of God.
Namaste, sir. Kaise hain?
Namaste, theek ho.
Sir, I read your two books, Invaders and Infidels, Volume 1 and Volume 2. I hope 3-4 more books are coming, because you have dedicated one book only to the siege of Devagiri and destruction of it. But what I found the most fascinating in these two volumes is how the cities that were glorious, say 1,000 years back, we have no memory of it. In fact, we don't even take a look at it. For example, Peshawar, for example, Multan. These were the cities that had brilliant Hindu temples, brilliant cities of their time, trade centers. So I want to approach it from that angle, because I found that nobody considers Multan, okay, it's gone now. Nobody even thinks of it. We think of, say, reclaiming Gyanvapi, reclaiming Mathura, Ayodhya. But these we have completely forgotten. So I want you to enlighten what those cities were. Let's start with Multan, or what we used to call Moolisthan.
Okay. Thanks for having me here, Arihant. Interesting that, you know, you are approaching my books from this fashion. But in fact, it's nice that, you know, you approach it from this perspective. Why do we not remember the histories of all these places? Because we have lost every geography is also what I call a narrative memory. History and geography are intimately tied. They're inseparably tied. Now, when you say you want to reclaim Kashi Vishwanath's temple and the 500-year battle for reclaiming Ayodhya, which has become a reality, why we are fighting for these things is precisely because the structures were physically demolished, but they still remain in the Hindu homeland, which is the truncated surviving version of what used to be known as Brihad Bharata or the undivided India. So once you cut off, physically sever any part of geography, it could be 10 kilometers, 100 kilometers, or almost 33% of original undivided India's landmass, which is today Pakistan and Bangladesh and Afghanistan.
Yeah.
Just look at them on the map. So you lose all memory of that, because memories are made by people. Where are those Hindus who have kept alive that memory in Pakistan? What survives of whatever surviving Hindu population in Pakistan? What memories do they have? they want today's generation of Hindus in Pakistan, living in, say, what is known as Multan, they won't even remember the fact that Mulasthana once enjoyed the same sanctity. It was a great Tirtha Kshetra which was on par with Kashi, Rameshwaram, Kanchipuram, Ayodhya, Prayagraj. It enjoyed the same status because of it was one of the grand Surya Kshetras.
Aditya Temple.
Aditya Temple. So that was a cynosure of the city around which it was built. Millions, it had a revenue comparable to, say, Tirupati. So you demolished that temple. It was finally gone in 9th or 10th century. Some Shia Karmatian sect came and vandalized that. You know, demolished it. It didn't stand back again. You know, Aurangzeb also, it was resurrected for a bit and then it vanished from memory. So Mulasthana became Multan. So the nomenclature itself is significant. I'll give you one more example of another city near Mulasthana. Or not near, but
Bhatia?
Two, three, no. Okay. It is called Brahmanabad.
Hmm.
So it is a curious nomenclature. Brahmanabad. It is an unlikely marriage of a pure Sanskrit word with a Persian or an Arabic word. Bad meaning town or city or, right? Like Allahabad, Ahmedabad. So what do you mean Brahmanabad? It is named Brahmanabad because of a mass genocide of, it was a Brahmin majority city. And it became known due to this genocide, just like Hindu Kush, signifying the mass murder of Hindus.
Yeah.
So when you approach this history from cities, which is actually quite nice, you get Multan or Mulasthana.
And it's interesting that in Mulasthana, for a long period of time, once they conquered it, they didn't destroy the temple.
They didn't.
Because it was so revered that they used that as a shield. So whenever the Hindu kings would try to enter and conquer it and, you know, defeat Muslims.
Expel Muslims from there.
Yeah.
They held that Aditya Murti as their life insurance policy. He go back, don't try to reclaim the city. Otherwise, we will demolish this temple. So this is another facet. And this happened not just with Multan, but many other places which have gone unrecorded. From that, let's come to something called Islamabad. This is a city which did not exist before 1960.
So new capital they made.
New capital they made from scratch. And look at the name they've given. Islam originated in the desert of Arabia. So you have Mecca, Medina, other places out there. But you will not find a city called Islamabad anywhere there. You will find it in a former Kafir land which was carved out of India. Undivided India.
The whole thing is Pakistan.
The whole thing is Pakistan.
Land of the pure.
Land of the pure. So its capital is Islamabad, city of Islam. That is the only Islamic republic carved out in the 20th century.
Interesting.
Without physical warfare in the traditional sense, that kings used to fight, you know. No.
Wahi hai na, haske liya Pakistan,
ladke lenge Hindustan. So this, that is there. And thankfully for us, there is still a city called Rawalpindi. Rawal is Rawal, Bappa Rawal.
Oh, okay.
Named after
him. Named after him specifically.
Rather his clan.
Okay.
Rawalpindi. Rawal means Rai, Rao, meaning Raja. So there's a dialectical titles.
Yeah.
It basically comes from the word Raja.
And Pindi maybe
is... Pindi is...
maybe it came from that Punjabi
pind. Punjabi thing, yeah.
So, Mulasthana is
Mulasthana
this.
Is Multan. And Multan, by the way, has the world's largest concentration of Sufi shrines in a single city.
The peaceful Sufis.
Peaceful Sufis. So it has the world's largest collection of Sufi shrines in any place. Comparatively, it's a very small city, geographically. But this is a thing, a profusion of Sufi
and
shrines.
What's the history of that Sufism? For
Sufism came into India, it's not like a monolithic thing that, you know, all happened in at once or was concentrated in one place. It arrived, Sufis arrived first, I think, on the western coast, Gujarat specifically. They came during, with the Arab merchants during the Rashtrakuta period. So, I mean, they didn't pose a threat, you know, in that sense, in the military sense that became commonplace later.
I would come to that later because it becomes a central point when you discuss Devagiri.
Okay.
The way they used Sufis. But I was asking, like, what is the relation of having so many shrines in Multan?
Multan was also a melting pot for various Islamic sects in that sense.
Okay.
So people from various travelers from Central Asia, from all the way from Turkey also. So you have to put yourself back in time, how the transport and, you know, things were happening. It was one of the great centers for the Qalandari Sufi sects. A lot of internal Sufi schools are there within them, the Qalandaris and then the Chishti sect and, you know, all these various different branches of that. So it became a melting pot of that, Multan. And as a result, plus you had a lot of royal patronage for Sufis. And that is one reason why it has so many Sufi shrines there.
And then another city like that, Purushpur, which is Peshawar.
Purushapura.
That destruction is also mentioned in your book.
Those centers all fell very early. In the sense during Mahmud of Ghazni's invasion. And then after that, with the destruction of the Hindu Shahi kings, they were the borderline, you know, frontier
first
line of defense for us. Once that dynasty was, you know, pretty much exterminated, then it was pretty much easy after that. So a typical invasion would begin from, say, Ghazni, then come to, say, Peshawar, and then come to Kabul. Different routes, basically. I'm just giving a random order.
Yeah.
Kabul and then Zabul, or I think I mentioned Peshawar, then Mulasthana, then Lahore. So at one point in time, by the 11th century or mid-11th or 12th century, Lahore was one of the Islamic world's greatest slave trade markets. As early as that, it had become a slave trade market.
So basically, the whole thing started around 712 or 700.
Yeah, yeah. Qasim came around 712.
Yeah.
And Qasim was just a raider.
Hmm.
He did not come here to, neither was he under any illusion that he'll come and establish an empire here. He was given an order by his uncle come father-in-law, Al-Hajjaj, who's based governor of Iraq. So he said, you know, I've attacked this land of infidels for 2-3 times, but unsuccessfully. This is perhaps my last chance, because my boss is a Khalifa sitting there.
And he doesn't want anything to do with the Hind.
Yeah, do not, he's given a definite order. Do not undertake any expedition into Hind, because every expedition that I've sent so far has drained my treasury, has not only drained my treasury, but has resulted in the unnecessary slaughter of a lot of Muslim blood. So desist from another expedition. So this fellow offers him the lure of, you know, plunder, and he appoints, you know, sends his nephew Qasim here, and that fellow comes here, raids, plunders, does a lot of destruction, goes, he doesn't stay in India for more than 3 years. He goes back to Baghdad, where he's captured and killed.
And you referred to this thing of lure of money.
Money,
repeatedly in your book. So what is this mindset that despite you you show off that you care about the Musliman blood.
Mm.
And there is another instance I forgot where one king is, for Sultan is saying that I don't want this fort.
Mm.
The blood of Muslims is more
Jalaluddin Khilji.
Jalaluddin Khilji.
Okay, so this is...
This is common thread throughout the innovations.
Common and uncommon.
Yeah.
And contradictory in many places, actually. So... How do you want me to answer, in brief or in detail?
In detail, as much as possible. Because I want, whenever I'm asking these questions, the reason is that I want you to narrate the stories. For example, when we talk of Multan, we want to discuss who did this, why did they do it, what was the strategic importance of this.
Mm.
So with these stories of these cities, we want to tell the whole story.
Yeah, fine. So who did this in this, if you frame it like this, who did this occupies a secondary place as compared to why they did it.
Mm. Exactly.
So the why, the answer to the question why, is in what they regard as their holy scriptures. And who wrote it, we don't know who actually wrote it. Somebody codified it. There were scribes, but who ordered these things to be written? Who, led this whole thing? Gave birth to something known as Islam. Story starts there. So loot, plunder has always been an intrinsic part of the manner in which Islam expanded since its founding by Muhammad, who is known as a prophet. Right? He did not go about preaching his religion in a peaceful manner, like a sadhu or sant, as a way we understand a religious preacher in Sanatana Dharma. It was always the threat key, look, I have gotten a revelation from God himself or angel Gabriel or whoever it is, but some divine unseeable origin.
Hmm.
So he has commanded me and given me a new religion. Please listen to me, embrace it. It is for your own good. If you don't, be prepared to die. So this is one fundamental thing. We'll park it in one side. So when nobody listens to your peaceful teaching because it is supposed to be a divine revelation, which has not been revealed to anybody except you. So there's no reason for the masses who are already following their own religion undisturbed, which is keeping them happy. And they see no reason to embrace any new religion. Why should they believe you? So what is the other way? The other way is violence. And how do you do this? By organizing enough number of people who either genuinely believe you or you somehow convince them through lure. Look, I know you might, in your heart of heart, you might think I'm a madman. Okay. But notwithstanding my madness, if you support me, if you follow me, you will get A, B, C, D. You will get women, you will get plunder, you will get this, you will get that. So these spark this also, number two. Now, number three, you look at the Arabian region of that period. That whole region has always been tribalistic in nature. You know, the pure bloodline. Even today, marriages in all these elite Arabian families are decided by purity of blood, rather purity of tribe. So, and each tribe always considers itself superior to the next, to the other. So, and they are always at war with each other. So what Muhammad did with his new religion and his temptation of money, plunder, whatever, was to unite them into a strong military force. And little by little, he began to say, look, and he borrowed very generously from the Old Testament and New Testament also. This is recorded. So once you have at least a fighting chance, what is your next strategy? It has always been a militaristic, imperialistic religion. The ultimate temptation is this, and you give it a, cloth it in the garb of sanctity. That, this is, I am not anybody. I am the messenger of Allah. he has commanded me that this entire earth belongs to Islam. Whether I'm there or not, you have to continue the war till the whole world becomes Islamicized. So this is a great temptation. You have to transport yourself back into that medieval mind, that tribal mind. So we're sitting here, you know, in the comfort of the thing. We've all read all fine theories of, you know, Rousseau and atheism and God delusion. And it is very hard for us, for this mind, to comprehend that mind.
Mm.
Which operated primarily on inherited beliefs and strict customs. You cannot change that kind of a mind. So Muhammad tried to do that. He did it, but through force. Until he became, you know, the supreme guy out there, how did they accomplish that? Only through the lure of plunder. The flight, the initial successes and or failures of Muhammad are all military successes and reverses.
Hmm.
They were not episodes of, you know,
debate, shastra, vakyar.
So the objective of our debating tradition is not to convert anybody. It is to establish a philosophical truth.
Hmm.
Why would you need a sword to do all that? Or violence to do all that? So with greater plunder attracts, you know, greater followers. So what is the nature of these followers, sir? What kind of people were they? Basically bandits.
So this is
all the heroes that the Islamic annals glorify as saints or whatever, great people who died in the service of Islam, they glorify their warfare, their campaigns for expansion. The only way to acquire political power, even Mao said that, you know, political power flows from the barrel of a gun. Okay. So this is exactly, that is an eternal truth. If you want to wield political power, you better wage war and win it. But in pre-Abrahamic times, wars were waged, but there were certain codes, there were certain ethics, don't kill women, don't kill children, this kind of thing, right? There is no concept of dharma yuddha there.
Mm.
It is victory at all cost, any cost. There are no rules. So this is how Islam expanded, and he integrated all these warring tribes under one banner called Islam. And within 40 years of his after his death, it began ravaging a vast sweep of the earth, all the way up to Egypt here, then Spain.
I think when the Spain invasion happened, it was simultaneously with the
Simultaneously, this fellow was raiding here, Qasim.
And still, if you look at it, it took 500 years.
It took 500 years from, that is the subtitle of my book.
Yes.
From Sindh to Delhi. So that is a journey.
500 years and there.
And there they fell like nine pins.
Yeah. So I think in within one century,
within
it
one
was
century,
all over.
All over.
So what is the reason that, especially Sindh, because that was the frontier. So how they were able to repel these invasions? We think that invasion hua, sab khatam ho gaye, aur ye Delhi pe pahunch gaye, aur fir hamara 800 saal ka ye gulami shuru ho gaya. But this was not the case.
Never. Hindus never gave up fighting, sir.
Yeah.
See, we had huge empires. What one, I don't know if I can call it a failing or ignorance. Yeah, ignorance certainly. The knowledge of Hind, in their eyes, there is something called early Arab geographers who predated Qasim. And they were there from, like I said, around the time of Rashtrakutas also. So they left behind some accounts of the Indian condition, including the various routes, the geography, customs of the people, their society, all that. But they were far and few between. And that knowledge, the knowledge about India, was neither complete nor completely accurate. So based on that, these Al-Hazrat type of people tried, you know, formed their own opinions, thinking that what they knew, all these Arab travelers, what they were unanimous about is the amount of wealth that India had. So plunder, plus it was, they also observed that, you know, the light of the true religion has still not been, it has still not been shined upon India, in Hind.
On a land which is so prosperous that you want to invade it for its wealth.
Yeah, yeah.
But they are apparently lacking the light.
The light of true religion is lacking here.
Yeah.
So on these two points, they were unanimous. So based on that scanty knowledge, some of the initial invasions happened through the passes in Afghanistan and that Khyber Pass, all these regions. Yeah. Okay, that land route, they were singularly disastrous.
Hmm.
5 or 6 expeditions, they were disastrous. Then they came from the Makran coast.
And that is how, that you mention how it has the Muhammad connection.
Muhammad connection. So that, anyway, sea route, this guy, Muhammad bin Qasim, he was outfitted with some 6,000 ships, you know, well prepared. And then that Raja at Debel, he was Dahir. He had beaten them back 4 or 5 times before. And so he thought, ab kya karenge ye log, fir se aage. So he became complacent. Then there was also the treacherous correspondence with the Buddhists did with the Muslims. A lot of factors contributed. So that was the maiden raid of Qasim. So again, plunder. He goes back to Sindh with great plunder. And this brings me back to that point about the Multan temple. You said that, you know, they did not demolish it. What Qasim did during his very first sack of Multan, he looted the temple completely, slaughtered many Hindus, converted them, you know, took them as slaves. What he also did was he vandalized the temple, slaughtered a cow and put its intestine as a garland around the murti of the Aditya temple. With the intestine of a cow. And the same thing, some of these behavior patterns have remained consistent. The same thing happened in not 1 or 2, but 10 or 15 temples in Kerala during the Mopla genocide of Hindus.
1921
CE to 1921 CE, just a century back. That behavior pattern has not changed. 3 years back, what happened in Chandni Chowk, Durga temple? Murtis were broken for a reason. Although there's no cow to, you know, garland the intestine, it's not for the lack of will.
Yeah. Definitely
but,
not.
But for the force of circumstance that it didn't happen.
Yeah. And another great cities where Hindus dwelt was Kabul.
Yes.
And many other cities in Afghanistan, which we don't even have any memory.
Yes.
Forget anything. Like at least Multan, there is some connection ki it was ours. For Afghanistan cities, there is nothing.
Kabul comes from the Sanskrit word. It is named after Nadi, a river named Kuba. Kuba. From Kuba, you get the name of Kabul. Peshawar, Purushapura, these are all names mentioned in Ramayana and Mahabharata. Madradesha, Madri, Gandhara, sorry, not Madradesha, but Gandhara, that is Kandahar. Shakuni comes from there. Dhritarashtra's, his sister, Dhritarashtra's wife, Gandhari, she comes from there.
And just a few centuries,
Purushapura was a great Buddhist center.
Yeah. And just a few centuries after they were converted.
Mohammad Ghori's ancestor, sorry. Before I
said. No. Please.
I'm not cutting you.
No, of course.
So, 3 generations before Muizuddin Muhammad B. Sam or Muhammad Ghori, 3 generations before him, they were all Buddhists meditating in the caves in Afghanistan. You see what an Islamic invasion does.
There is another story of Muhammad also where there is his uncle or somebody who's meeting him and then he says, my mother is somebody like in relation that my father or mother is ailing and like you don't go because they are not Muslim. Some stories like that.
I know this story, but I'm not sure if it if this occurs in Muhammad's Ghori's life.
Not Muhammad Ghori's, Prophet Muhammad's.
Prophet, no, I don't know. Okay. But I've heard this.
Yeah, that story is there.
Because he's not a Muslim.
Because even in your like mother or father is not...
Yeah, yeah. In your family, yeah.
So forget three generations, to bahut hi piche chala gaya.
So you see why apostasy is such a great weapon. Even if you want to, you cannot quit.
You can only enter. You can't only enter.
The door closes behind you after that.
Yeah. And this... Buddhist ka betrayal was also one thing that you mentioned. But as we go, like this Pakistan thing, even after he, Muhammad bin Qasim, takes over these cities and he's expelled and he's killed brutally after the change of caliph. So even after 200 years, when Muhammad Ghori comes, even then the Sindh area... From Karachi to, say, Peshawar and Kabul, it was not fully converted.
No.
Majority of it was still Hindu.
No, on the contrary, Muhammad bin Qasim goes back in 715 or 76, yeah, around that time. Between Qasim and Muhammad Ghazni, Muhammad Ghazni first, Mahmud Ghazni, first invades mainland India in 1000 CE. So you have almost how much? 300 years of gap. There is no alien invasion from that period into India. So what does it tell you? You get a picture that after Qasim goes back, majority of the Hindus who had been forcibly converted, they return to their Matra Dharma. They rebuild their temples. They reconquer their territories. And apart from Multan, there is only one more island, island city, called Al-Mansura. Now it is called Mansura in Pakistan. So it's it used to be an island city. Now I don't know what it is. So those are the only two places where, you know, Muslim governors are stationed. And they say with extreme fear that a place for which a Musliman could take refuge is not to be found in the entire Hindustan. This is what they say. So that is the thing. You have 300 years. And even after Mahmud, you know, the story is well known how he demolishes Somnath and goes back. He causes extensive damage over a substantial territory for the first time. So that kind of causes a great setback and commotion and disorder in India. But after he goes back,
even then,
Somnath bounces back to double its glory, previous glory. Why? Because you had strong Hindu powers.
Even the resistance, when he's looted the temple and he goes back through somebody diverts him to...
They mislead him intentionally.
A Hindu merchant misleads him. Yeah, by the time he reaches with all the plunder that he was supposed to have, he didn't have anything.
90% is gone.
Yeah.
He loses it on the way.
So imagine like there was such a strong civilizational commitment.
Yes.
That people know,
you know
that this is an invader and it has to be punished.
Yeah. So this, from there, after Mahmud to Muhammad Ghori, who comes almost a century after him. And even he doesn't have it easy. So his first expedition, he takes inspiration from Mahmud before launching his campaign. He prays at this fellow's Darga, Mahmud's Darga. So even till this day, in Orthodox Islamic circles, Mahmud of Ghazni is regarded as one of the greatest Ghazis that the Islamic world has ever seen. So this fellow prays at his Darga, then takes inspiration and tries to follow his same route to go back and plunder Somnath again. But he gets stopped near Anahila Patana and he gets, you know, battered very badly, goes back
by then a boy. Launches
by a boy, a teenager. Who leads the battle from the front, inspired by his mother, who is from Goa.
But that also backfires on us
later. Later, much later.
Complacency.
Yeah, complacency.
Yeah.
So this happens. They didn't have it easy.
And even like we talked about the cities in Pakistan, there was this Bhatia city, which most likely the Bhatia Khatris mostly come from.
Kshatriyas.
Yeah.
Khatris are Khatri, corruption Kshatriyas, of
Kshatriyas. Yeah. So mostly I think the Bhatia surname is originated from there.
Yes.
Then we come to Ajay Meru, which we today call Ajmer. I want you to tell the story of that city through that invasion and what it changed, because it was such a center of knowledge, Sanskrit. And then the mosques and the seminaries came and how it became known. Today we know it as a chadar jahan dene jate hain prime minister
aur
sab big chadar chadti hai wahan pe.
So Ajay Meru literally means, you know, Ajaya is that which cannot be defeated. Meru is a mountain. So literal meaning of Ajay Meru is a mountain which cannot be defeated or conquered. So this corruption is Ajmer. For the longest point after the scattering of the Hindu power, the downfall really begins with the death of Sriharsha, Harshavardhan of Kanauj. So under him, the entire North Indian Hindu power was under ek chhat ke andar tha, niche tha. So once you lose the protection of that one, you know, mighty power to which everybody obeys unconditionally, then you're pretty much left for fending for yourselves. Each person has a empire building ambition without understanding what it takes to consolidate and maintain an empire. So Harshavardhana did not leave behind any dynasty, any successors in that real sense. So Hindu power in the North India is scattered, and it is a playground of competing different Hindu powers. As a result, what are known as Hindu Shahi kings, as Hindu Shahi dynasty, they were all the feudatories of Harshavardhana.
So even
they could protect, they protected, they thrived in such hostile border areas like Afghanistan. These are all very, even today it's a very harsh terrain.
Yeah.
So they could thrive there, they could flourish there because they had this confidence that ki mera samrat hai wahan pe. If I get into trouble, he will come on his horse riding right in the front.
This was the power of centralized.
Yeah, you don't have that anymore. So to the extent that they could, they managed to defend our borders. We should not blame them in any fashion. On the contrary, we should show some sympathy to them. That they gave everything they had out of a genuine interest to protect their dharma.
And you mentioned the king,
Jaipal Deva.
He was
the last frontier hero.
Yeah, continuously
fighting
even after getting converted.
He didn't get converted. Anandapala.
Anandapala was converted. Yeah. Even then he bounces back.
But Anandapala also reverted back to Hinduism. Yeah.
So that was possible.
Yeah.
And there was no pollution attached.
We can't compare Hindus of today with them.
But there was something that lacked, which we call weakness. And that was the... Today, that is the emphasis, unity. So that was lacking at that time, or that thinking, strategic thinking.
Strategic thinking, in a way, yes, you're right. But what they lacked was the unifying vision of someone like, say, Chanakya. Till the Gupta era, you look at the peaks of Hindu civilization. Most of them, you will find majority, 75% of all our achievements climaxed during the Gupta period. After that, something changed. They lost this unifying vision of Guptas. It's not that Guptas didn't have any enemies. It's not that Hindu kings stopped fighting with each other during the Gupta period or even beyond that. They did. But what they did not lack is this sense of this Brihad Bharata, this sense of a Bharata which is united culturally. Ki a Gupta could fight with a Pallava, and he could conclude a peace treaty and become a samdhi with him. This is not unknown. But what they lost, what India Hindu kings lost after that era, was precisely this fact. that what is known as Aryavarta consciousness, that this land is sacred and we need to defend its borders no matter what.
Mm.
Our borders are the territories which we have conquered.
Not just
our
state.
Not just the borders of India. This consciousness they lost.
Mm. And apart from this consciousness, once this started coming, like Ajmer ka battle of Tarain, that is also...
See, that's a classic case.
Yeah.
If Prithvi Raja had not forgiven this fellow, Gori, in the first battle of Tarain, remember, he is the one who wins.
Yeah.
He didn't have that vision and he sent him back. He forgave him, said, don't repeat this, go back. Who does this?
And we see this repeatedly, that whenever they were defeated, they came back.
Yeah.
Always came back.
Yes.
Whether it is Qasim, whether it is Gori,
no,
whether
Qasim
it is...
Qasim didn't come back.
I mean,
yeah.
He won,
yeah.
But Gori, Ghazni,
yeah.
They always came back.
They came back.
And still we didn't learn.
We didn't learn.
What was this?
That's what, loss of Aryavarta consciousness. What they lost is this consciousness that internally, I can illustrate this with an example from Mahabharata. When the Pandavas are in the forest, Duryodhana says, he's instigated by the great Karna, saying that, look, we must humiliate them even more. Let us go and, you know, humiliate them in the forest. So they go there, then the Gandharvas attack the Kauravas. They abduct them and they imprison them. Then Yudhishthira says, no, no matter what, we have to rescue them. They are one of our own. So Bhima or somebody says, you know, why they've, you know, humiliated Draupadi in the full court and they have sent us to forest playing this unethical game of dice.
Mm.
Why should let them suffer? So Yudhishthira says, fine, within our borders, okay, they are 100 and we are 5. But to an enemy, we are 105. Okay?
This consciousness, even today,
is not there.
Is not there. And we talk about that 300 saal mein kya seekha? Yahan pe 1300 saal mein kya seekha?
Yeah. This they lost. They didn't see that I am a Chalukya, I am a Pallava. Both of them, they will either, you know, wage wars with each other, or if there is a Vishnu temple in your enemy territory, your enemy king or businessman or merchant was free to come and do business there. Cultural exchanges, linguistic exchanges, arts, utsavas, there was no barrier between Hindu kings, even though they were sworn enemies. Okay. But what they did not realize is that with an enemy like, say, Mahmud or an Alauddin Khalji, he will not see you as Pallava or Chola or Chalukya. He will see you as a kafir. And your temples as hubs of idolatry and infidelity, which have to be destroyed. This they didn't see. They didn't realize this.
There is another parallel theory that runs that people, somebody I know wrote on Twitter, I think, a thread or something, that when Ghazni was invading Gujarat and desecrating the temple, Somnath temple, Rajraj Chola was in Madhya Bharat.
More or less.
So there is another, like, why he didn't go there and punish him? Because he was at that time the greatest emperor of Bharat. He had such a huge empire at that time with navies and all. So there is another, like, do we have any theory that why we, do we have anything recorded in history or any other kings, like, who were neighboring?
No, you can find hundreds of such examples, sir.
Yeah.
Why do you want to take Rajaraj?
And they were Shaivites.
Correct. No, no. Let's not go into the Shaiva and Vaishnava. They were Hindu kings.
Yeah.
So there's a simpler explanation for this. Why do you want to go so far down as Rajaraj Chola? The nearest king there was Bhojaraja, Paramara Bhoja.
Who was also a
he
great
was part
king.
Of Gujarat, no?
Yeah.
Lot of his territory, dominion, Somnath was also part of it. Sorry, it was part of the Chalukya thing, but Paramara, he was in Madhya Pradesh, Malwa, Ujjain, Dhara Nagara was Dhar. That was his capital. So he could have done something about it. Whole point was that when Mahmud came, he stood outside the gates of Somnath. The people there, the previous night, they were partying. Partying not in today's sense, but, you know, carrying on life as usual, worshipping and things like that. And they thought, 50,000 of them, citizens, soldiers, whatever, they were warned that, you know, this alien guy is there, you know, he might cause trouble. But these people had, you know how they rebuffed them, their logic. Somnath is a guardian deity of Shiva himself, is a guardian deity of Somnath, the city. As long as he's a guardian deity, nobody can do anything to this city. This was the attitude, this was complacence. Why? Perhaps I can make a speculation, I mean, can be wrong, right, whatever. Because long years of experience had taught them that when two Hindu kings would wage war with each other, they always followed the code of honor on battlefield. That is, no killing cows, no killing women, no killing unarmed citizens, no killing children, no vandalism of temples. So these fellows also thought Mahmud was one such guy.
Despite 300 years of history.
Yes. They didn't have this kind of long-term vision. Ki, you know, you learn from this. The first, because until the longest time, Hindu kings thought that Muslims were also kings like that, like them. It is inexplicable that at the height of the power of the Vijayanagara Empire, at the same height that the Maharaja's seat was, another throne was built on which Quran was placed. With the desperate hope that ki, at least this gesture will drive some sense into the heads of these fellows. How did they repay them with? Battle of Talikota?
Such a great blunder, like after 800 years.
No, this is the repeated failure. That because, be it Hindu kings or philosophers or great saints, they did not study Islam at the doctrinal level. The first person to do this was Swami Dayananda Saraswati. Again, from 712 to Swami Dayananda Saraswati.
More than 1,000 years. You talked about this lure of plunder and loot. This incentive gave rise to the house of Khalji.
All houses.
All houses, but the most disastrous that proved to be for us.
Yes.
You mentioned Bakhtiar Khalji's invasion of Bihar and Bengal. You say that this was the period, Bakhtiar Khalji's invasion, where Islam earned most converts in India.
Yes.
Is it true, or that credit should go to Aurangzeb, who converted apparently most of the western Uttar Pradesh and other areas in Uttar Pradesh, neighboring Delhi?
No. So you're talking about, Khalji was 12th century, Bakhtiar. Yeah. Aurangzeb was 16th and early 17th century. So about 500 years. Okay. When I write that Bakhtiar gained the maximum, it was during his reign that India earned in hard numbers.
Okay.
Islam earned a maximum convert. So if Islam could change, that was Bakhtiar Khalji was a man responsible for the first time the entire fundamental character of Bengal. When I say Bengal, it is today's Bangladesh also.
Yes.
That's a huge area. Then southern Bihar. So this is a massive area in which he attained the maximum number of converts. Now, what was the condition, what was the relative Hindu-Muslim population in the rest of India during his time? It was quite feeble. From that angle, yes, Islam earned the maximum converts. But what you're saying, by the time of Aurangzeb's period, this spree of conversions that, you know, forcible conversions that he effected in a relatively small geography, Western UP, all these places, those conversions did not sustain for a long time.
So Aurangzeb's were not sustainable?
No, not sustainable at all.
Okay. So all these...
And remember that Aurangzeb did this during peacetime, in the sense that when he was the only sultan to actively send out these campaigns for converting Hindus.
So
Bakhtiar hardly did that. You know, whatever conversions he made on the point of sword during invasion, that's all. And number one. Number two is that 70-80% of all the Hindu shrines and temples in that region, Bihar and southern Bihar, Bengal, physically demolished. I'll give you the stats in the book. I've read them.
Including Nalanda.
Yeah. So this is the thing.
You dedicate the whole one book to Khaljis, how they rose, and the reason we said incentive of plunder, loot, and how they enriched themselves back in their homeland.
Yeah.
And then the importance I understand, because the subtitle is about Devagiri, because that opens the portal to South India, invasion of South India. And there is another portion left, whole portion of Alauddin Khilji's conquest left, that will come in third book. So you dedicate a lot of things to this, a lot of space to this one dynasty, which was nothing just 100 years back when they came to India.
Yes. Okay, so every invader who came into India, and at any rate, Qutbuddin Aibak established some kind of a foothold in the so-called, he's called a founder of the so-called Muslim slave dynasty or Delhi Sultanate, whatever you want to call it.
Which was only probably limited to Delhi.
Very limited, very limited. Yeah. But what he brought with them, and along with him, his master, Muhammad Ghori. So they used to maintain a class of aristocracy and military who all hailed, they were all Muslims converted from various different races. So you had Mongols who later were known as Neo-Muslims. You had Tajiks, came from Tajikistan, Kazakhs, Uzbeks, then Khaljis, Afghanis, Ghoris. So they were all tribes basically who were converted, and then, you know, they were
different
fighting races, warrior classes. So Khaljis were also one such warrior class. And they were initially a pastoral nomads with Turkic origins. The name Khalji, I think Al-Kashgari, he gives us the derivation of the name Khalji as Kal Ak, which means sons of thief. So these are different linguistic things, but some of those stories about their origins, notorious. I'm mentioning that. So they, from pastoral nomads, they became warrior tribes. They learned the art of, you know, riding horses and carrying out mobile warfare. And they accompanied various kings, not kings, but raiders. They came with Qutbuddin Aibak. Then they occupied a pride of place during Iltutmish's, in his army military unit. Then they rose to prominence, mostly, most notably, under Balban. So Balban promoted Khaljis, and one of his most competent governors was a man named Jalaluddin Khalji. So, but when Jalaluddin became the Sultan, he was 70-72. His own nephew was Alauddin Khalji, who murdered
him. Was also
him.
Son-in-law.
Yeah, son-in-law and nephew. So his brother also, Almas Beg, he was also son-in-law and nephew. And this is common there.
Yeah.
So he murders him and, you know, declares himself as Sultan Alauddin Khalji. So after that, the fortunes of Khalji's decline. So this is the thing. All these so-called medieval slave dynasties and post... So Khalji, the House of Khalji, if you want to give it such a dignified name... they are the first non-Mamluk or non-slave tribe to come to political power. So Balban is a slave. Before him, Iltutmish is a slave. Before him, Qutbuddin Aibak is a slave.
Slave of a slave.
So that is pretty much done. And with Balban's death and Jalaluddin coming on the throne, the whole contact with Central Asia is cut off. So, wo hai. All these are tribal guys who variously come to power. And what is common between all these so-called dynasties? Aibak dies before leaving a solid dynasty behind him. So, it's over. They're the so-called houses, right? They are only as long-lived or long-lasting as their most powerful sultan is sitting on the throne. They don't, none of them have left behind a dynasty. Aibak doesn't leave behind a dynasty. Iltutmish, he declares Razia as his successor. She gets murdered. So it's all, you know, palace coups and patricides and fratricides and all these things.
So in this picture, when we see the Khaljis, they are the most devastating.
And in terms of altering history, and obviously we can speak in hindsight, Alauddin, the possibilities that he opened up, he was the first sultan sitting on Delhi that broke open the door to Dakshinapatha by raiding Devagiri. His maiden attempt, which this book ends, book two ends with his maiden raided Devagiri, but after he raided that and went back to Delhi, even he did not, for some time, even he did not kind of have this ambition to go beyond Devagiri. But that's a story I'll tell later in the next book.
Okay. So he didn't
But he opened up. Until he stormed Devagiri, all the Muslim power which was scattered in, concentrated in North India, the seat of power was Delhi. But the actual control of Muslim political power did not extend beyond a radius of 120 kilometers. And with the change in government, with the change in sultan, each time a new sultan came to the throne of Delhi, they had to reconquer territories from Hindus.
So it was not stable in any sense.
No.
But with Alauddin, it...
Yeah, we'll see that in the next subsequent portions.
In Devagiri, one interesting aspect, there are two interesting aspects. One, how he invades. And then there is treaty that was supposed to be materialized, but then the son of the
Ramachandra,
he messes up.
Yeah.
That is interesting story. How strategically foolish that thing was. I mean, given that it was not foolish, he thought that it could, it was, he could win. But I want you to tell that story. And another story about how Alauddin Khilji used Sufis as a Reiki, as a people who do Reiki and tell all the information, all the secrets about a particular region that has to be invaded.
So I'll tell the first story, second story first.
Yes.
So Sufis, contrary to modern contemporary fashionable Hindus who actually believe that there is something...
Raitas, you mean.
No, I don't believe in these categories, but in the popular current notion of about Sufis by in the Hindu psyche, some of them actually believe that there is something called Sufi music. There isn't. For the longest time, Sufis were, sometimes they were the unofficial powers behind the throne. So their history...
It's a long history.
It is a very long history.
Yeah.
So their history can be broadly split into four or five categories. One as freelance Reiki agents. Okay, they, one of the greatest compliments that you can give a Sufi is to call him a Diwana.
Deewana.
Yes. Deewana for what? Madman. Insane, crazy.
Deewana for what?
No, Deewana for Allah. So that is why, you know, they make all these grotesque faces and these roll their eyeballs like that and leave long hair and dress up weirdly. You know, their nails are 1 kilometer long. Why do they do this? It is deliberate. Nobody is questioning their piety towards Allah. But when you reach the logical end of that piety, it will result in Hindu genocide. Sufis were responsible for keeping Muslim sultans continuously on the boil. Now, you invade a kafir territory and you win the war. You kill that fellow, you know, convert them, take over his empire. And then you are happy, you know, fine, ye bhi mera hai, Delhi bhi mera hai, Chandigarh bhi mera hai. What you want to do after the victory? You want to sit back,
relax,
lie around, relax, enjoy the spoils booty. Of war. Spoils of war, you know, take all your booty, have friends, you know, party with your friends. Generally declare yourself the Sultan of the earth and, you know, enjoy your luxury. Sufis would not let them do that. In their eyes, they are like, look, you do, tum karo, tum aish karo, lekin kal ya parso tumko marna hi padega. And then I will tell you, I predict that you will definitely go to Jahannam and burn in hellfire. Because you are supposed to carry out the commands of Islam. What are you doing? You are enjoying. Thereby forgetting your duty. What is your duty? Is to enforce the law of Allah more properly, even in peacetime, which means more jizya, more pilgrim tax, a proper, thorough, ongoing operations of Hindus in peacetime. So Sufis used to provoke these fellows like that, the sultans like that. Even perchance they had, you know, an element of civilizing element, you know, a civilizing force in the form of dance and music. No, those are all haram. So Sufis used to enforce it, you know, feed them with fear and guilt. At A, not enforcing Islam, B, being lax in enforcing Islam, C, threatening you with hellfire, guilt. So this is one. Two is Recce agents. Because by their very nature as men of God, pious people, no Sufi has ever harmed, like a proper Sufi saint had never carried a sword, you know, went out on a horse with a sword. No. Generally, the Sufis who would allegedly spread the message of God, they were not different from our yogis and monks, Hindu yogis, wandering monks.
Was that a strategic use?
I'll come to that.
Okay.
So, by nature, Hindus are, the element of piety is in our DNA. You cannot worship a stone or a river or any force of nature either in Christianity or Islam. Okay? So for us, everything is sacred. So they mistook these Sufis and, you know, they would become recluses when it suited them. But what they would do as recluses is, you know, follow their Islam, obviously, and either pretend that, you know, this, what I am saying is the same thing as what your Babas and Yogis are saying. So that's why a lot of these fellows also learnt yoga and meditation. Sufis, just to lure. So when you are in minority, lure them. Theek hai? But, and then Hindus would obviously give them jo bhi bhiksha hai, jo bhi hai. So these were naive. We are very naive people, sir, even today. So they would, you know, patronize them in whatever little way they could. Unko ashram banwa do, jo bhi banwa do, all the time. And then when they heard that some sultan was coming to extend the borders of Islam within India, they would help him in every which way. Alauddin, when he encamped himself about 25 kilometers or 20 kilometers from Devagiri. Maximum intelligence he got about local intelligence, about the conditions in and around Devagiri, was supplied by Sufis. There are still two great dargahs near, I mentioned the name in my book, forgotten the name, at the foothills of Devagiri. Every Thursday, lots of Muslim pilgrims go there and give their chadawa and whatever there. He was the first or the second great Sufi to settle in Devagiri and spread the light of Islam. This happened during the reign of Yadavas, Devagiri, Sevunas of Devagiri.
And they didn't suspect?
Why would they suspect, sir? They had no inkling of that something like this could even be called a religion.
Because they didn't study it.
They didn't study. It comes back to the same thing.
Is this Sufi thing particularly unique to India? Or is it?
I don't know if it is unique to India because I have not studied the history of Islamic conquest in detail in other parts of the world. Because maybe we don't have enough information, because we have the fortune or the misfortune of being the only non-Abrahamic civilization
to have sustained,
who have survived to tell the tale. Otherwise, I don't know. I wouldn't be writing this book.
Yeah, exactly.
We have preserved that memory.
In the sense, like, there are no... I haven't heard of Sufis in Iran or Iraq.
No, there are Sufis everywhere.
Achha.
But the destructive role that they have caused, which has been documented by their own sources, is fairly extensive and they've been preserved. Aulia was a Sufi. Amir Khusro was a Sufi.
Yeah.
Then there is some other Dehlavi guy. Amir Khusro name is also Dehlavi, but another Dehlavi is there. He is also Sufi. Jahangir's teacher was a Sufi. Shah Jahan's teacher was a Sufi.
And Ajmer is Ajay Meru.
Ajay Meru.
That
Darga, Chishti, he is a Sufi.
And what his role also, as you describe again, in detail in the book.
Yeah, that story is fairly well known. So this, they did act as recce agents. They acted as recce agents, even merchants also. Muslim merchants who would travel, you know, in various Hindu kingdoms. They were unmolested. Tum kya secularism ki baat karo, yaar? They were unmolested by every Hindu king. In fact, Rashtrakutas are to be blamed. They allowed a lot of these Arab traders to settle along the coast of Gujarat. Sanjan, for example, it's a port city in Gujarat. It is not coincidental that a lot of maritime trade between Arabia and Rashtrakuta Empire there, there's a lot of, it was flourishing. They had a flourishing maritime trade from that city. It is also not a coincidence that the Parsis, who were persecuted in Persia, landed first on the shore of Sanjan.
Same shore.
So all these things are, they have very, very delicate, deep interconnections.
I know there are many questions that I want to ask, but agar main wo pooch lunga to fir koi book padhega nahi. Isliye I am leaving things.
Sure.
There are so many things that need to be covered. But when you look back at all these invasions and the reaction of infidels, what are your lessons today for today's generation that need to be at least civilizationally aware of the threats that we are posed with today?
Don't lose the memory of this. If you want to survive, don't lose the memory of your past persecution. And every act of vandalism, temple vandalism or love jihad or whatever other crimes, that don't interpret them using the lens of today's political theories or your weird, not weird, but maybe well-founded intellectual theories. Don't analyze them using that. This is not a subject for an internal, for an intellectual discourse or debate. It is a question of your civilization and your survival, and the survival of your children.
Only the terms have changed.
That's
the titles.
It's the same
but
thing.
But the core remains the same.
It is the same.
So thank you so much for discussing this important work of yours. There are so many books that you have written that we need to talk about.
Okay.
Hopefully when you come back in a few months, whenever you come back to Delhi, please give us more time so that we can do more episodes with you.
Okay.
Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thanks for having me here, Arihant. Thank you, sir.